Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up on today's program, the latest from Cyclone Evan that devastated Samoa and Fiji. Also on the program, cheap labor in China on the decline, and it was a deadly year for journalists. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Fiji's military has had its Christmas cancelled in the wake of Cyclone Evan. Around 300 uniformed personnel are involved in the cleanup. And the normal Christmas stand-down period for the Republic of the Fiji Military Armed Forces has been postponed until the job is done. Land Forces Commander Colonel Moses Tagola says his men are highly motivated to help with the relief operation. He spoke to Bruce Hill.
Now, the RFMF has always, in the past, taken a lead role in disaster management in Fiji, including natural disasters. We've been very active in the initial stages of preparation. We had our people in the National Disaster Management Office manning the operations room there and coordinating efforts of all government ministries to make sure that we are prepared for the cyclone that was coming towards us. We went through that phase, and we were also very much involved in the awareness campaign, going out to communities and telling them, helping them prepare themselves for the disaster, ensuing disaster. Then we sat down and waited for the disaster to go through, and straight after that we deployed all military personnel available to go out and rehabilitate, first of all, give reassurances to the community, give relief to where relief can be made immediately, and do assessments for ensuing government efforts in providing both relief and rehabilitation. We have over 300 personnel now out doing cleanup in cities. Initially, yesterday morning, straight after the cyclone went through, we had personnel at the airport cleaning up the runway in preparation for the reopening of the runway.
How do the soldiers feel about doing this kind of job? It's not really military training, but I suppose it is helping people in a more direct way.
Yes, the Fiji military forces has always taken this active role in all past disasters. It's not the first time we're doing it. We're a better structured organization to go out and help as an organization or an institution. To go out and do this kind of help. Yes, it is not military task. We don't take any military equipment except for our uniforms, and we go out and do all sorts of things, from cleaning up the streets to doing some relief work where possible, and in the later stages we will be doing the rehabilitation work.
So what kind of actual jobs are the guys doing? Are they picking up trees or digging out mud, that kind of thing?
Yeah, the task ranges quite widely from holding the broom and cleaning the streets of our suburban towns with the help of the fire brigade, watering them down, to running a chainsaw across a fallen tree and picking up the pieces, loading them on trucks, and taking them away and dumping them in appropriate places. We also do assessment of, we have assessment teams that have gone out to very remote areas, including the remote island in the SAO groups, to do the initial assessment of the damages and what are the possible challenges that the community faces that may require immediate government attention.
Of course, the military has some built-in advantages in this sort of situation with the better sort of secure communications network and also ability to transport things into areas that normal vehicles would have trouble getting into.
Yeah, certainly that's a big advantage that the military organization has. It is communication equipment. We're able to talk to each other when the normal mobile telephones and the telephone lines get broken down in such cases as we have now in Fiji. We're also available not only trucks to cut things around, we also have troop carrying vehicles that we can transport people around. There needs to be some movement of displaced people that have damaged homes that were needed to be moved to evacuation centers, and the military is doing all that effectively.
You've been out having a look at how the army's performing, or what's the morale like? How are the guys feeling about this?
Because most of the people or the military forces that went down to the western side from the eastern division, where the cyclone did not affect too much, and because they went across and saw the stressful situation, the Western Division were in, it motivated them to work even harder. Bearing in mind that we're coming very close to Christmas, and Commander RFMF has declared that the RFMF will not go into Christmas stand-down, that we will work through Christmas, ensuring that all Fijians are in a position to celebrate Christmas before we can even settle down and complete the activities for the year.
Of course, getting accurate information during a cyclone, typhoon, or hurricane is vitally important. Any natural disaster is. But recently, because of Cyclone Evan, concerns have been raised that Pacific Islanders could be in danger because they don't understand the official cyclone warnings. Official warnings usually contain a lot of technical information about hectopascals and longitudes and latitudes rather than plain language. Following the deadly Cyclone Evan, which has devastated Samoa and Fiji recently, concerns have been raised at the highest levels that the warnings of immediate danger aren't getting through. Kathy Harper has more.
Would you realise that a cyclone was about to hit if you heard a warning like this?
Tropical Cyclone Evan was located at about 14.2 south, 172.6 west, or 27 nautical miles south of Tonga, 44 nautical miles southeast of Asau, or 53 nautical miles southwest of Apia at 12.15 UTC or 5 a.m. this morning.
That's part of the official information released by the Samoa Met Service last Thursday, the day that Cyclone Evan hit Samoa, leaving at least five people dead and more missing, including 10 fishermen. Staff at the Samoa Met Service did do radio interviews that day, which stated in more simple terms that hurricane force winds were expected and when. But the Samoan Prime Minister, Tuilaepa Salele, says the message didn't get through in Samoan.
There was one word called lafa, which means in English storm. All you need to say is that one word, and everybody understood. But the technicians confined themselves to the actual words used by the technicians when describing the strength of the winds and also a below cyclone stage. I think that was the main problem. It's a problem of language. I have been stressing that to our people ever since the 1990 of a cyclone, the 1991 Vell cyclone, the Heta cyclone. But I think the main problem has been the flood, not so much the wind strength. It's the flooding, the flash flooding, which our people did not really give equal emphasis, because we had never before seen such a flash flood that came so suddenly like a tsunami wave after wave.
The lead forecaster at the Samoa Met Service, Mulipola Ostalia Titimaya, says information was provided about possible flooding. And he says he believes simple language was used to warn people of the danger approaching.
I think we do understand that there was a dangerous situation, but I do agree that we need to make the warning a bit simpler.
The Prime Minister said that he's been trying to get forecasters to use simpler language since the 1990s. What's your response to that?
I've got nothing to say to that, but we will work on that, because this is perhaps a feedback that we need to sit down and look at this time, because there were so many changes in wind speed and different categories within a short span of time. It's perhaps the reason why we've provided intermittent watches in between.
Do you think it's something that you could have put more thought into before the cyclone?
Well, this was we have done this in the past. We have reviewed this in the past, and this is perhaps one of the areas that we will be looking into in the future. It has worked for other systems in the past few years, but I'm quite concerned, as the Prime Minister has said, and then we will have to work in reviewing it with our counterparts in American Samoa.
It's not a problem confined to Samoa. Fiji's Permanent Secretary of Information, Sharon Smith-Johns, acknowledges it was also an issue in Fiji in the wake of Cyclone Evan.
The weather forecasters are very, it's 9 decibels south and west, and at times it is difficult to understand. Translating that for us was a challenge through this as well. Whilst the information flowed extremely well from the Met Office, and I can't fault them, sometimes it does need to be in plain English. And I think out of this, that's something that we will take of getting those plain English messages out.
Meteorology and climate advisor with the Secretariat of the Pacific Region Environment Program, Neville Coop, says cyclone warnings that are couched in technical rather than simple language is a long-standing problem.
In the past, we've had many circumstances where these sorts of issues have been raised. Unfortunately, not a lot has happened over the years to train meteorologists in how to better communicate with people who use their information. You have to bear in mind that in a lot of Pacific Island countries, we have many languages. We have the need to translate information into vernacular, in some cases in Melanesia, 20 or 30 different island languages that need to be considered when you're preparing information. So it's not a simple task. The next issue is that in the Pacific, meteorologists are seen as scientists and technicians, and so there's a tendency to talk in a way that reinforces their role in society as scientists and technicians. And what we're trying to do is to find ways that they can talk to people more as if they're just having a conversation rather than as a scientist. It's not just confined to Fiji and Samoa. It's a problem that really also applies in Australia to some extent.
Cyclone Evan resulted in several deaths in Samoa. Do you think that you can link those deaths with the widespread problem that people seemingly didn't know it was coming?
It would be impossible for me to make any connection with regard to individual circumstances. What I can say is there is a broader issue of whether or not people are properly prepared whenever warnings are issued. An example here is that a number of people who were lost, whose lives were lost in Samoa, were fishermen who were at sea. Now, whether or not they should have been at sea or not is a question that we'll have to look at.
Low-wage labour has been responsible for China's economic transformation and for putting ultra-cheap manufactured goods on Western shelves. But the era of cheap labour in China could be coming to an end. The latest global wage report from the International Labour Organization shows continued sharp rises in Chinese wages. And while that may create opportunities for other low-wage countries in the region, China's underdeveloped provinces may reap the benefits. Bill Bainbridge has the story.
When Apple CEO Timothy Cook announced the company will invest $100 million next year to relaunch part of its manufacturing operations in the United States still battered by the global financial crisis, it was big news.
Made in America, claiming a kind of victory tonight. The American powerhouse, Apple, famous for its giant manufacturing operations in China, has promised to do something they have not done in nearly 20 years. Build some Apple computers right here in the United States. And
one explanation for the shift is that the huge gap in wages between Chinese and American workers has been getting a little smaller. But another is that making an iconic American product in the U.S. is simply very good PR.
Those three words we've been reporting so much here, made in America.
I definitely think it would have more to do with Apple's marketing in the US. When you buy an Apple product, be it an iPod or an iPad, it's quite conspicuous that they have the labeling on it, designed in California, assembled in China.
Economist Glenn McGuire from Asia Century Advisory says manufacturing has seen particularly strong wage growth in China.
Wage gains in the private sector have been running in the double digits, and in some years we've actually seen wage gains of around 20 to 30% per annum.
According to the ILO, real wages in China have tripled since the year 2000 and increased by more than five times since 1995. Malte Lubke is the senior regional wage specialist for the ILO based in Bangkok. He says the economic crisis has dampened wages in the rest of the world, with China accounting for nearly all wages growth globally in 2011 and 2012.
The figure without China reflects that wages actually were falling in developed economies. So you see this split between high and sustained growth in China and some other emerging economies, and very sluggish wage growth in developed economies.
The ILO's Director General Guy Ryder is touring Asian countries at the moment, urging them to use their newfound prosperity to make progress on social issues and promote fairness. Malte Lubke says China's wage increases mean other countries in the region can follow suit.
The killer argument always was, but wages are lower in China. And if you now look at the data for minimum wages, it's actually no longer true. Chinese minimum wages are in the textile exporting provinces like $150 to $200, and that gives other countries like Vietnam a chance to adjust their wages upwards without losing out to China.
Glenn Maguire says most of China's wages growth has been in urban and coastal areas where manufacturing workers now bring in around $5,000 a year.
But as you move into the central and western provinces, those wages start to fall. And in your far western provinces, wages growth is as low as $1,500 per annum. So a lot of the development plan and the infrastructure build that we've seen in China over the past decade is aimed at allowing migration of manufacturing platforms inland to take advantage of those cheaper labour costs that we're seeing.
And he says China still has a huge advantage over its neighbours in its vast logistical networks.
So I think what you're more likely to see is that production will shift inland in China rather than production will shift to other economies like Vietnam or Bangladesh.
The ILO's Malte Lubke says China will be able to continue to increase wages as long as it remains on the path of countries like Japan and South Korea by making higher value products like cars and high-end electronics.
I think it is sustainable because what you see is quite a substantial structural transformation in the Chinese economy as well. If you just look at the export sector, you see a big shift away from labour-intensive and resource-based manufacturers. There used to be about half of all exports in 95. That's down to a quarter now. And you see a very, very strong rise in medium and high skill and technology intensive exports. It used to be about a third in 1995, now it's about 60%. So you see, in a sense, a transformation from sort of T-shirts to iPads. And obviously that's a very, very good sign. It's a sign of success, China moving up the value ladder.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. It's been a deadly year for journalists covering political upheaval around the world. The latest report from the Committee to Protect Journalists shows that more political reporters than war correspondents were killed in 2012. 67 journalists have lost their lives in the line of duty so far this year, including 28 in Syria. The vast majority were local reporters and camera operators. Only 6% were foreign correspondents. Saui Sarah speaks to Joel Simon. He's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
The reality is that most journalists who are killed around the world year after year, it's 85, 90%, are local journalists who are killed in their own country. They're covering politics, they're covering human rights, they're covering corruption, and they're targeted for murder by people within that society who don't want their activities exposed.
So from your figures, it's almost showing that being a political journalist is more dangerous than being a war correspondent.
It's absolutely the case. That's in no way to minimize the threats that war correspondents face. And this year, in fact, we've seen a huge increase in the number of journalists covering conflicts because of what's happening in Syria, which has been devastating for journalists. But year after year, if you look at the long-term statistics, it's journalists working in their own countries, reporting on political corruption, reporting on political scandal, reporting on human rights violations, who bear the risk and bear the consequences for that kind of coverage.
And what does your research show you about, with the best information that you have, who's responsible for those killings?
Well, it's often local political forces within the country. Sometimes they're politicians themselves who have organized killings. Sometimes there are criminal organizations with ties to political groups. Sometimes there are militant groups that also operate with some sort of political protection. So the political environment is often the crucial determining factor. And you know what else is absolutely determinative is impunity. In country after country, if the killers of journalists are not brought to justice, then the cycle of violence is perpetuated. And we see that in places like the Philippines, like Russia, like Mexico, like Pakistan, like Somalia. Year after year, those countries are on the lists of the most deadly for the press.
Tell us about the countries that have come in, if you like, the top 20 most dangerous countries for journalist deaths. I noticed that Afghanistan is not there, but Syria is sitting at the top.
Yeah, Syria has just been unbelievably deadly for the press. In fact, the number of journalists killed in Syria this year is rivaled only by Iraq at the height of the conflict. It's really been devastating. And you're seeing two classes of journalists who are killed. You're seeing the traditional kind of international correspondent who goes into Syria, and often there have been a few that have actually been abducted, but often they find themselves in crossfire and a number have been killed. But local journalists are also incredibly vulnerable, and many of these journalists are not traditional journalists. They're kind of activist journalists with ties to the Free Syrian Army who perhaps are integrated into networks of activists. But they're playing a crucial role. They're documenting the day-to-day reality. They're disseminating information to a global public. So they're really playing a journalistic role. And about 13 of them have died as a result of their activities.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that group because I know in other countries, in India, for example, those activists who are involved in a right to information, which is their equivalent of FOI, freedom of information, that's become a very dangerous task as well. Is there enough recognition of these people that provide information but are activists as well?
You know, it's really been evolving, obviously. I mean, it used to be pretty easy to say where journalism ends and activism begins, but that's not the case anymore. There's so many groups around the world that use the gathering and disseminating of information, which is essentially a journalistic function, to advance their activist goals. And these include human rights groups, environmental groups, groups agitating for greater freedom of information. But we believe that in many cases, not all, and we look at each case very carefully, they're playing a fundamentally journalistic role. And so we classify them as journalists and we count them as journalists when they're killed.
So this group of activists slash journalists, they're often bringing out footage and information from areas that traditional news organisations can't or don't want to venture into. In some ways, is this group taking some of the hits for the traditional media?
Yeah, well, I think that what you're seeing around the world is that repressive governments recognise that in order to retain power, they need to control the flow of information. And so you're seeing a real showdown in many places around the world, places like Iran, in China, in the Middle East, in Egypt, in Tunisia during the revolutions that took place there, a real concerted battle over who controls information. And in many cases, it's activists slash journalists that are playing the role of documenting and disseminating both to a domestic audience and to a global public what is transpiring in these countries. And they're paying a huge price. Many have been killed. Increasing numbers are being jailed. And they're working without institutional support. When they get in trouble, it's not like a journalist who has a media organization behind them. They have nobody. They have the Committee to Protect Journalists. They have media organizations, but they're much more vulnerable. And governments recognize this, and they're going on the offensive.
As 2012 draws to an end, the Philippines can look back on significant progress throughout the year. But in one area that people are saying, well, we should hold off for a bit because it's not exactly as rosy as it may seem, that's the area of starting new businesses. And people are suggesting that, well, they should take their business elsewhere. Corruption, poor regulation, and red tape have put the country near the bottom of the international rankings for doing business. The head of the government's Competitiveness Council says he can turn that around. Karen Snowden has the story.
If you're running a business in Manila, you might as well be in Ecuador, Sierra Leone, or Tajikistan. That's according to the latest World Bank report, which in October ranked the Philippines at 138 out of 185 countries. It's made the head of the National Competitiveness Council, Guillermo Luz, pretty angry. He wasn't available for an interview, but told a meeting of influential business people he can improve the ranking by 100 places in just 2 years. Businessman Alberto Fenix has been lobbying for that sort of change for many years.
We have put forward proposals and the government personnel would say, yes, yes, we agree, we should do that. And then, of course, nothing happened so far that can really say that we solved the problem.
Alberto Fenix is the past president of the Philippines' largest business association, the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and the managing director of several companies. He's been an advisor to previous governments. He says President Benigno Aquino has made good progress in fighting corruption, but it remains a huge problem and a drain on business.
The tax system is quite unfair, and there's a lot of possibilities of harassment and of corruption. Then, of course, there's still this big problem that we have a constitutional provision limiting foreign investment in certain areas. This really is counterproductive to us, and this is shown out in the foreign direct investment figures.
Well, those calls to loosen restrictions on foreign ownership and investment haven't been well received by President Aquino.
That's right. Well, he's not really adverse to this cause on loosening up the foreign investment, but he's, to some extent, he is adverse to amending the constitution now.
There's a 40% limit on foreign ownership in most industries in the Philippines, a complete ban on foreign media ownership, and in the practice of law, engineering, and medicine. The provisions were part of the 1987 constitution written by Benigno Aquino's mother, former President Corazon Aquino, and a hand-picked group. Alberto Fenix.
The first good step really is to call for a constitutional convention and amend or change our constitution, and that it be done somehow, that capable people can be elected to the constitutional convention and really come up with something much better.
This year, the Philippines will attract less in foreign direct investment than the $1.7 billion sent home every month by Filipinos forced to work overseas because there aren't enough good jobs at home. At $1.5 billion this year, it's about half the total foreign direct investment that arrived in 2007. Neighbouring ASEAN states do much better. National Competitiveness Council Chairman Guillermo Luz says he can overhaul the system to better protect investors and cut red tape for all businesses, whether foreign or local. And he says he can do it in just 2 years.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again, as well as catch all past editions, by visiting www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So, on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you all Merry Christmas, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.